Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the organizers, I want to welcome each one of you to the University of Hong Kong to join tonight's talk. My name is Walter Nai. I have to say I have this special connection with Ajahn. Ajahn was my preceptor for my novice ordination exercise, Duyn Khe Chit Ga. And I still remember vividly when Ajahn cutting my hair, and he said to me, Walter, when you letting go your hair, you start letting go your suffering. Okay, and I still remember vividly. And tonight's topic is hello, happiness, sex, family, money, and Buddhism. And sometimes you can hardly relate sex, money, to Buddhism or a Buddhist monastic. But when we are talking about this venerable gentleman, everything is possible. And Ajahn can always talk about things and with new perspective and bring you a lot inspirations. And tonight we're very, very happy to have Ajahn Brahm with us. And I hope, ladies and gentlemen, you will enjoy tonight's great time with a great master. But before I proceed, I have to remind, ladies and gentlemen, please sit tight and get prepared, because this monk can really make you laugh and make jolly jokes, okay? And without further ado, may I invite Professor C.F. Lee, Chairman of Management Committee of Hong Kong U Center of Buddhist Study, to introduce Ajahn Brahm. Professor Lee, please.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Actually, Ajahn doesn't really need an introduction. People like me need an introduction, but not him. He's so well known around and, you know, the Buddhist community and otherwise. Anyway, for those of you who may not have met him before, he was born in London. Let me make sure I'm right. He was a first class honors graduate in theoretical physics from Cambridge University. Am I right? Okay. Then he became ordained as a Buddhist monk at the age of 23. Today, he is the abbot of Bodhiyana Monastery in Serpentine, Western Australia, and the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, among many, many, many other duties. And to me, and to many of us, he's one of the most inspiring, most cheerful, most lighthearted, most humorous Dharma teacher that we know of. As Walter noted earlier, tonight he will speak to us on the subject of sex, family, money, and Buddhism. Well, I guess you all know he's a Buddhist monk with no money, no family, and no possession. So why would he pick up a topic like this? So, but we do know that he is always happy, he's always cheerful, always lighthearted. So tonight he will share the secrets of what keep him happy. And if you know this secret, chances are you can be happy too. So without further ado, would you please join me in warmly welcoming Ajahn?
Thank you. Some years ago in Perth, one of the people who had come to our center to listen to talks and to meditate was a radio producer. And he said that there are many talkback radio shows, which he produced, where members of the public would call in and ask questions from distinguished members of the community. And he said to me, he said, "You're very wise. You can actually answer difficult questions without any hesitation. Why don't you come on one of my talkback shows?" And I readily agreed. But it's very difficult to find the time. And so I said, "Well, I am free on a Friday evening, you know, maybe quite late after I've finished everything else. Now, can I come about 9:30, 10 o'clock on a Friday?" He said, "No problem, it's a talkback show then." So I arrived at the studios really late, just in time to go into the studio before they went on air. So I had no chance to be introduced to the presenter and to the other panelist who was going to receive calls from the general public. So I was straight with the earphones on and turning on the microphone as soon as I got into the studio. And then the presenter welcomed all the listeners to this show. And first of all, introduced the first panelist who was answering questions. And he announced this panelist as Professor Gabriel Morrissey, who was the preeminent sex expert in Australia. And when I heard that this professor was a professor of adult problems such as dysfunction in your genital areas, I was wondering what sort of show was I going to be on. I should have asked beforehand. Because at 10 o'clock at night till midnight, it was a show on adult themes. I thought, "Oh my God, what have I got into?" But as soon as they tried to introduce my name as Ajahn Brahm, and in Australia that was too difficult for people. I did tell someone earlier that sometimes people mishear that name. I gave a talk once at a Catholic girls' school in Perth, and I saw some of the girls the next day in the street, and they came up to me and said hello to me. And I said, "You remember me? Yes, you gave a talk at our school a few days ago. We will never forget you." And I thought, isn't that sweet? They will never forget me. And they said, "How can we ever forget a monk called Ajahn Brah?" And I said, "There is an M on the end." So at this radio show, we decided just to call me Mr. Monk, which is much easier in the West, Mr. Monk. And it was amazing. It was a 2-hour talkback show. And after a few minutes, all the questions from the general public were to Mr. Monk. And the sex expert, the preeminent expert in Australia who'd written many books and who lectured at prominent universities, she never received any calls at all. Which just goes to show, you don't need to know what you're talking about to make sense. Because I haven't had any sex in 40 years. I'm a monk and a good monk. But nevertheless, it's amazing that when you can understand the nature of the human mind, you understand the psychology of a human being. And whether it's sex, whether it's family, whether it's money, you can be very, very smart and understand things which other people just can't understand at all. So many of the questions were actually coming to me. Now, one of those questions, which I will never forget, was from a taxi driver. You know, taxi drivers waiting for a fare, they tune into the radio, and this man did have a question. And the question he asked was this. I will never forget it. He said, I am married. I'm having an affair. My wife doesn't know about it. Is it all right? How would you answer that? Very quickly I said, sir, if it was all right, you would not be ringing me up to ask. Because the psychology was very clear to me. A person like that, if it was all right, you wouldn't be asking anybody else to justify your misbehavior. The point was, he knew it was wrong. He just wanted some expert to try and convince him he was right and get rid of his guilt. So that's why I nailed him straight away. If it was right, sir, you wouldn't be ringing me up to ask. And he hung up the phone. So as a monk, you can nail people, you can get to understand how they're thinking and why they're thinking it, which is one of the reasons that the wisdom is actually pretty sharp and pretty accurate. So what about the sex? Now, you have sexual affairs with other people, it's part of human nature for some, but not for all people. Now, I was very, very supportive of the homosexual and lesbian and transgender community. And in fact, I was so supportive of them because there's nothing I see in Buddhism which should discriminate against a huge number of people in our community. And in fact, in Buddhism, you are totally welcome, treated just as any other human being, which is what you should be treated as. So when I went, because I was supporting the gay and lesbian community, that I was invited to the gay pride breakfast. And I was very touched as a Buddhist monk that you could be invited to this celebration by the gay community. And when I gave a little talk, I said to them, I am more deviant than all of you. I'm celibate. And I notice even these days in many parts of our world that the gay and lesbians are accepted and they're not so discriminated against. I'm not quite sure what it's like here in Hong Kong, but certainly in Western countries they are given the same rights and protections and respect as everybody else. But still today many people say celibacy is not natural. So I have threatened this, and one day I'm going to do it. The next time there's a gay and lesbian Mardi Gras, I'm going to get a float for celibate rights, for non-discrimination against people who decide not to have sex. And that's a choice you can have in your life. The whole point of life is that freedom. To choose your sexuality according to your nature, and there's a lot of people who prefer not to have sex. But those people who do have sex, there's nothing right, there's nothing wrong about having sex or not having sex, or lesbian sex or gay sex. It's how you have the sex, or how you don't have the sex. That is where the ethics and morality come in. And if you do it right, you'll always have some happiness and progress in your life. You'll feel free, healthy and happy. But if you don't do it right, if you don't do celibacy right, if you don't do homosexual lesbian sex right, if you don't do naturally heterosexual sex right, you will always have difficulties and problems in your life. It's not what you do, but how you do it, which is the most important. And one of the things which I can see, the sex which takes two people, maybe even three or four, there's all sorts of different things which you read about these days. It doesn't matter exactly what it is, but how you're doing it, why you're doing it, what's the attitude to what's happening. And as far as Buddhism is concerned, I try and use, one of the wonderful frameworks of Buddhism, of the original two types of Buddhism, Hinayana and Mahayana. Now, in Hinayana, It is supposed to be all about yourself, your own enlightenment, your own needs, your own problems. In Mahayana, you're supposed to sacrifice yourself for other beings. Both are wrong and nothing to do with Buddhism. Because it's never about me. It's never about you. As I've been teaching during this tour of Hong Kong, it's never about me. It's never about you. It's always about us. The third option. And I've told this, I have to repeat this to make it very clear. Whenever I do a marriage ceremony, and I've married many people, sometimes I tell people, they ask me, as a monk, are you allowed to get married? I say, oh yeah, I've married many girls. Doing the ceremonies for them. And when I do the marriage ceremony, I always include this little bit of teaching. First of all, I look at the bride, just after the rings have been exchanged. I call them handcuffs, they call them rings. And after the rings have been exchanged, I look at the girl first of all, the bride. And I look her in the eyes and I say to her, you are now a married woman. From this moment on, you must never think of yourself. And she always nods and smiles really sweetly. And then I look at the new husband. And I say the same to him. You are now a married man. You must not think of yourself. And in Australia and other places where I've done this ceremony, the man, the male, always pauses before agreeing. I don't know what it is about men. But eventually they agree they should not think of themselves. Then still looking at the man, the new husband, I say, and from this moment on, you must not think of your wife. And looking at her, I say, from this moment on, you must not think of your husband. And they always get quite confused until I give them the answer. When you're married, you must not think of yourself, nor must you think of your partner. You must only think of us. Marriage, a relationship, is all about us, not about me. That's Hinayana. Not about him or her. That's Mahayana. It's about us. And it's amazing that when I point that out, the couples actually get it. Because many of you may have been in a relationship where it's give, 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 give to your partner and there's nothing left for you. You get burnt out, you get dry, and soon the relationship doesn't exist anymore. However, if you are selfish, it's about me, again, that's not a relationship. That's just exploitation of the other partner. And there's no real marriage there. There's no relationship. The third option, it's not about me, it's not about you, it's about us. Shows you what a marriage is all about. And that's the same thing which happens with a sexual liaison, with sexual activity. If you want to take it to a beautiful level, it's not about me, my pleasures, my sexual needs, my physical demands, nor is it about satisfying you, my partner, who I love and care for. It should always be not about me, not about them, but about us. It is an activity, you know, which should reaffirm that care between the two of you. Not to the partner, not for oneself, but the care between you, which is a union of the male and the female. This brings you closer together. So if in sexual activity, you don't think of your needs, nor do you think of satisfying your partner. But you get this third little concept of it's about us, satisfying us, our commitment, our intimacy, our togetherness, our trust in one another. Then you're going to that level which takes it to a spiritual, a meaningful, and a very rewarding, you know, act in a relationship, in a marriage. About us, never about me, never about him or her. Because a lot of times when it's about me or about her or him, you also get this terrible fear coming into a sexual relationship. And so much problems come, and why they have psychologists. And psychologists are very expensive, which is why they come and see a monk, because we're cheap. You can come in us and give us a bar of chocolate, and then we'll sort of spend hours talking with you. So often they come, and it's like fear. And that fear, you know, is what prevents a person enjoying sexuality, which makes them just, you know, not really perform naturally. And so half of, you know, what you can talk to people about sex is, please have no fear. What is actually the fear of? It's again the fear of being judged, of not being good enough, not satisfying the other person, of actually being judged. And you find whenever there is fear, your performance always decreases and you never can do anything to your full potential. So part of the sexual act is to make sure, you know, you don't really need to have any fear. I always try and teach Buddhists, or anybody for that matter, please, you are allowed to make mistakes. You are allowed to fail. I learned this when I got my first bicycle as maybe about a 10-year-old child. Now, riding a bicycle, just two wheels, trying to balance, I was so afraid of falling off that I gripped the handlebars until my knuckles were white. I was so stiff through fear that when I went around the corner, my body couldn't move to balance the bike. I kept falling off. Why? Because I was afraid. And after falling off many times, I learned just to relax. When I relaxed and wasn't afraid, then quite naturally, you know, the body would move this way and this way to actually to compensate the angle of the bicycle, and I would never fall off when I relaxed. So I learned that fear is what causes you to fall off the bike. And when you're confident and you don't even think about falling off, you never do. And I learned that so often in life. If I'm afraid that people won't laugh at my joke, then they never do. But just if I go and tell it, and I don't really care whether they laugh or not, then they laugh. Like all the jokes about marriage. I know one couple, they've been married for 30 or 40 years. 40 years. And in those 40 years, they never had an argument. Never one argument. And when I asked the man, how come 40 years of marriage, you've never had an argument with your wife? And he said, it was because of what I learned on my honeymoon. On my honeymoon, he said, we went to the Grand Canyon in the United States. And on the first day of our honeymoon, we were on a pair of donkeys going down the path to the bottom of the Grand Canyon. And my wife's donkey stumbled. And my wife looked at the donkey and told that donkey, that's the first time. I didn't know what she was doing. But after a few minutes, her donkey stumbled again. And my wife looked at the donkey with anger and fierceness and told that donkey, and that's the second time. And soon the donkey stumbled again. And this time, my wife took out a gun and shot the donkey dead. And I asked my wife, what did you do that for? And she looked at me and said, husband, that's the first time. We've never had an argument since. So you see, when you relax, you can tell a joke and it comes across. But if you're afraid and tell a joke, it all goes wrong. And if you're afraid of your performance when you're having sex, it will go wrong. You won't be able to flow with it. You control it, because fear leads to control. And control leads to this natural process being obstructed, interrupted. It never works. So to be able not to be afraid, you've got to be able to fail. And there's nothing wrong with failing and making mistakes in life. You should be allowed to make mistakes. Which is one of the reasons I developed what I call the 70% rule. I learned this when I was a school teacher. Because I was a school teacher for 1 year. Only for 1 year. Because after teaching teenagers in a high school for 12 months, it made anybody contemplate leaving the world. I left the world. I actually did it. So, but anyway, at the end of the school year, I had to set an examination, a test, and it was in maths. And I didn't know how to do it, so I asked the senior teacher, how do you set an examination in mathematics? And he gave me some wonderful advice. He said, don't make it too hard. Because if the average school of your class is, say, 30 or 40%, they would lose their confidence. They would assume that they can't do mathematics, and they will give up. So I have to make sure that they're encouraged that they can succeed and do maths. I told another funny story today. I can't resist jokes sometimes when they come into my head. There was a boy in Hong Kong who was really doing very badly in maths. And his... You heard it this afternoon. They're already laughing. They haven't heard the punchline yet. And so, the parents changed the schools to see if they can get better math teachers. They even got tutors, you know, after school to try and help their kid with math. Because if you can't do maths at school, your career options are so limited. You know, all you can really be is maybe a monk. But eventually, they sent him to a Catholic school. And after a few weeks in the Catholic school, his grades in mathematics went up, 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 up. And they were so impressed. And so they asked him, is it because the teachers in the Catholic schools in Hong Kong are so much better? And his child said, no, that's not the same as the other schools. Is it because the discipline there? He said, no, the same as other schools. Well, how come you've done so much better in math in this Catholic school than all the other schools in Hong Kong? Well, Daddy, said the son, as soon as I went into that school and saw that boy nailed to the plus sign, I realized they were serious about maths in this school. The boy nailed to the plus sign. They were really serious about that. That's why I had to get my act together. But when I... It took you a long time to get that joke. This is supposed to be a university. You're supposed to be intelligent. Come on. Anyhow. When I gave my first maths test, they said, don't make it so hard. But also, don't make it so easy. Because if everyone gets 90%, 95%, it's a waste of time. He said, aim for a 70% average score. Because if most of the children get around 70%, they'll be encouraged. Yes, they can do maths. But where they make mistakes, the 30% where they make errors, that's where I, as their teacher, can get feedback. I can learn their weak points, the parts of the lessons they did not understand. So in the next lessons, I can teach the areas which they never understood. So he said, that's how to set an exam, 70%. And I realized that's not just in examinations in schools or universities. That's in life. If you always get 100% in life, you don't learn anything. Have a wonderful life, but you don't grow. If in life you get 50%, 40%, if 30% you get so depressed, you probably commit suicide. You do need encouragement, success. But too much success is not worth it. 70% is the best. Because where you fail, you'll know your weak points, and that's where you can learn, grow, and improve. And that's so important in life. So if you've got a husband who's 100%, it's a waste of time. Throw him away and get... 70% is the best. Because that that's where you can learn. And the same in anything else in life. You know, in your sexual activity, you don't need to be 100%. If you're 100%, again, then you never really learn and grow. You know, how to just improve your performance. So where you make mistakes, mistakes are allowed, accepted, part of life, the part where you learn, grow, and improve on everything in life. So that's why when you're allowed to make mistakes, you're not so afraid. You don't have to be perfect. Because everybody, I tell them that everybody is somehow damaged by life. And sometimes they just can't perform as 100% expert on sex, marriage, money, or anything. And if you don't believe me, I ask people to go to a forest, a natural forest somewhere in Hong Kong or elsewhere in the world, and please find for me a perfect tree. A tree which is vertical, not leaning to the left or right, which is not crooked. A tree which has every branch equally spaced, only green leaves, no yellow leaves, no brown leaves, no damage to the bark. Find me a perfect tree if you can. I've never been able to find one, except in government plantation. And I don't like going for a walk in government plantation. I like going for a walk in the natural forest, don't you? The natural forests are beautiful. Why? Because there's not one tree which is perfect there. They're all bent, crooked, branches hanging off, lots of orange and brown leaves, lots of marks and wounds in their bark. That is why they're beautiful. So if you are damaged goods, you belong to the trees in the beautiful forest. Welcome. And when you can accept your damaged goods, you are scarred by life. You are not perfect. At last you can relax and be the damaged, crooked tree that you are. And then when you have something like sex, because you relax and not afraid, you don't have to perform 100%, 70% is all right. Because you lower your expectations, you can usually relax and perform really, really well. And you can focus on this wonderful energy, not in you, not in her or him, between you. And there just have a wonderful experience. It's not for me, it's not for her or him, it's always for us. And then the sexual act does actually become, it has to be consensual. It has to be a coming together. It's not my demand, it's our needs. And when you have that, it enhances the whole idea of a family life. Of not about me, him or her, but always about us. And if there is any problems, any dysfunction, any difficulties, we don't go around blaming each other. If you blame your husband because he doesn't satisfy you, he comes too quick. If you blame your wife for always having headaches. If you blame somebody, you're missing the point. If there is any problem in a marriage or in sexual performance, whose problem is it? Ours. Yes. So it's a problem, you know, for if you're having sexual performance, you know, you have to sort of put some effort into it. You know, just to make each other attractive. You know, just not to just go and just come home from work without having a shower. You know, just look after yourself. Make yourself attractive. I remember the story of this man, and he could never find a partner in life at all. He tried but never could make it. And so he asked one of his friends, and his friends took him aside. Look, I'm a close friend of yours. Don't be offended. But look at you. Your teeth are all crooked. And you got bad breath. Your hairstyle. You know, it was like in the 60s. 1860s, that is. And your clothes. They're a mess. And look, you've got no personality at all. So he said, look, sort it all out and make yourself attractive. And so he took that on board. If he wants to have a partner and have sexual relations, you've got to be attractive. You've got to get the sort of hormones going. So he went to an expensive dentist. He got his teeth straightened, his halitosis fixed. Cost him thousands of dollars. Tens of thousands of dollars. He went to a personality coach who taught him just how to relax and how to speak with confidence. And he went, before he went out the first time, he went to an expensive hairdresser and got a really, really good, modern, good-looking style. And he went to Armani and got himself a really sharp suit. Thousands of dollars he spent on this. And the first night he went out to the singles club, just outside the singles club, he got hit by a truck and killed. And when he went to heaven, he was really, really pissed off. He was really upset. When he saw God, he went up to him and said, "Why did you do this to me? I spent all this time, all this money, getting myself attractive, and the first night you killed me." And God said, "I'm very, very sorry. We never recognized you." But anyway, that only is in jokes. In real life, just you make yourself attractive. Put forth some effort. And I do remember when I went out with girlfriends before I became a monk. I always have to say before I became a monk because, you know, sometimes these days people doubt what you're up to. But when I went out with girlfriends, you know what impressed me with the girl I went out with? It wasn't really just, you know, her dress or putting on makeup or perfume. What really impressed me that she went to the trouble to try and look attractive for me. She went to the trouble to do that. And that really impressed me. That would turn me on. And that's the same with girls as well. The very fact, as a guy, you go to the trouble to make yourself attractive, clean, well-groomed, counts a lot. It's just an expression of care, enough to put forth time and effort for the person, you know, you're attracted to. So that's so important, that care and showing that care through effort. That's a turn-on for a person. So if you want to have sexual relations with someone, whatever it is, put some effort into it beforehand. You know, it's a consensual thing, and they want to know, the partner, no matter what it is, you care enough about them to actually to put forth that time and effort. And it's difficult dressing yourself up as a girl. And all that makeup too, it takes hours. And I feel so sorry for females. The fashion that you have to wear is sometimes so uncomfortable. I always remember when I was in Melbourne a few years ago, they had a fashion called, I think the halter tops, had low jeans and skirts and high little jumpers or jackets. They had this whole bare midriff exposed. Now that might be okay in LA where it's nice and warm, but in Melbourne in the winter it's more cold than Hong Kong. And I saw all these girls, fashionable girls, with this exposed midriff going blue with the cold. And I felt so sorry for you. You know, as a guy, you can just wear almost anything, but be careful there. Don't just wear anything. Put some effort in. And that effort is showing that you care, putting forth the effort, and it will be responded to. It's a great investment if you want good sexual relations. And also, when you do have that sexual relations, it's not what I want, my needs. It's about our needs. And when it's about our needs, no fear. Just go for it. If it doesn't work, you make a mistake, doesn't matter. 70% rule. Which means that because you're not afraid of failure, you don't fail and you have a wonderful time. And the second thing with the sexual performance, which we always say this in Buddhism and meditation, present moment. Don't worry about what's going to happen next. Don't plan for the future. If you live in the present moment, you get this wonderful lack of fear. You just really, literally go with the flow. How many of you have ever tried to do a performance, whether it's a musical performance, giving a public talk, or, you know, playing sports, and if you really worry about what's going to happen next, you're not putting the effort and attention to what's happening now, and you mess up. I've noticed that so often. If I'm trying to think of the story I'm going to tell you next, if I'm telling a joke and keep thinking about the punchline, I keep on laughing, and I laugh so much I can't deliver the punchline. You have to always be in the present moment. And that's also with the sexual act as well. Present moment. Just be here right now. Forget about the past. Forget about the future. And if you're in this moment, you're getting energy, putting effort, and you're enjoying it. So often in life, we can't enjoy the moment because we're always thinking about what's coming next. We can't really enjoy this. Which means the energy and the effort gets dissipated. And so that way, you can have wonderful sexual relations. And if it doesn't work out for any reason, again, who's to blame? Us again. So you don't have this terrible thing that you think you're not satisfying your partner. Or you're blaming your partner for not satisfying you. It's always an us thing. Now we learn together, we grow together, and just know this is a together thing. And so we learn to do it better every time because it's all about us. No blame, no fear, in the moment. And you're not a monk, you're not a nun. Enjoy it. And it can be then, not just for pleasure. It is pleasurable, but it's something higher than that, deeper than that. The beautiful intimacy when you lose yourself in another. It's about us. And so those experiences can take sex into a totally different sphere. And this is something which Buddhism can recognize. If you're going to do it properly. Now, this is, I know one monk said this once, and I don't really agree with him. He said, if you're going to be a thief, do it properly. Don't get caught. But I'm not sure about that's good advice. But you can see that, you know, it's nothing against any precepts. And it's important you have sex. Because you're giving the opportunity for beings to get reincarnated. If you didn't have sex, there would be no beings being reincarnated in the world. And there's a big backlog of people wanting to be reincarnated. Do you want to be reincarnated next lifetime in the human realm? So please, let's make some more spaces available. No, so sometimes it's, you know, that sex is part of life. But then we get to the family. Now, family is not just husband and wife. Again, it's the children as well, which come out of the sexual acts. And sometimes people don't know how to live in a family, which means we're always arguing. There's an old saying, in the first year of marriage, the husband listens to the wife. In the second year of marriage, the wife listens to the husband. In the third year of marriage, the neighbors listen to both of you. Because you're arguing and shouting so loud. And why is it that you sometimes you can tell how long people have been together by the way they speak to one another? And it's always really niggling bad speech. And to me as a monk, when I see that, that really is disappointing. So if that you starting criticizing your partner, putting them down, please be aware that you're doing that and please stop it as soon as possible. That's killing your relationship. There's a saying which apparently is in the book which you printed about my sayings, if you cannot improve upon the silence, shut up. Be quiet. So before you think about saying anything to your partner, are you improving on the silence? Or are you just making it much worse? Think about that first of all. And if you're in a bad mood, because you just come home from work and you just got fined by the police for speeding, or you just lost a contract today at work, if you come back in a bad mood, please be quiet. Don't speak and spoil it, because one bad word can ruin sort of days and days of marriage. And if your husband, you know, says something, don't argue with him. You don't argue with your wife. One of my favorite stories for marriage, and this has saved many marriages. That's why I love saying it. It's a story, again, it's a favorite golden oldie for many of you. It's a story of the chicken and the duck. Because there was a couple, they were just recently married, and they were walking in the park in the forest one day after lunch, hand in hand, they were in love, and they heard a sound, quack, 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 quack. And straight away, she said to her husband, oh darling, listen to that, that's a chicken. And he said, pardon me, it's a chicken. And she said, no darling, that was a duck. It went quack, quack, it's a duck. And she said, no, 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 that was a chicken. I'm sure of it. It went quack, quack again. There you go, it's a chicken. He said, it can't be, it's a duck. She said, no, I am sure that is a chicken. He said, it can't be, it's a duck. She said, it's a chicken. He said, it's a duck. D-U-C-K, duck. And she started to cry. She said, it's a chicken. And then, I enjoy telling the story, even though you've heard it before. Then he realized why he married her. And he realized what's really important in marriage. He squeezed her hand gently, looked into her eyes and said, darling, I think you may be right. That is a chicken. And she looked into his eyes, thank you, darling. And they enjoyed their walk together, and that evening he got a hot dinner and sex. And that was one wise husband. Why? Because in a marriage, does it really matter if it's a chicken or a duck? Is that worth ruining your evening just because you want to be right? That's not important, being right. What's important is being in love. So if she says it's a chicken and it goes quack quack or moo moo or woof woof, it's a chicken, okay? And number two, just because it goes quack quack does not mean it's a duck. We always think we're right. That could be a chicken from Fukushima in Japan, which goes quack, quack, mutated because of nuclear radiation. So sometimes we think we're right, and it turns out we're wrong. And because we thought we were right, and we were wrong, we argue with people we love and destroy our relationships. Is that really worth it? People who understand that story understand the reasons why marriages break is because we forget what's really important in marriage. It's the us. It's the relationship. It's being in love. It's not about being right or being wrong. It's about being in love together, which means you can let those little things go. And you know that most of the problems in a marriage are all about little things. They're the ones which eat away at our relationship, and eventually we break up. And it's such a sad thing to see. The second thing in marriage, whenever I do a marriage ceremony, I make people promise to do what we call the Buddhist forgiveness ceremony. Once a year, usually on their anniversary. It's a traditional ceremony in Buddhism. Now, in our monastery, we do a forgiveness ceremony. Whenever someone leaves the monastery, we ask forgiveness of one another. The start of our winter rains retreat and the end of the rains retreat, we do a forgiveness ceremony. And I try to introduce this to people in marriages. Every year on your anniversary, you get a token gift for your partner. A token gift, nothing expensive. Just a little token is good enough. And you present it to your partner, it doesn't matter who does it first. You present it to your partner, this little gift, and you say, "Darling, whatever I have done, said, or thought in the last 12 months, which might have hurt you or irritated you, either intentionally or I didn't mean to do it, but it hurt you. I ask your forgiveness. I'm sorry. Or things which I didn't do, which I should have done or said. Please, I apologize. I'm a human being, imperfect. I make mistakes. Please forgive me, because I'm committed to you." And it says in the Buddhist Sutras, this is in the Devapūtta Saṅgita, in the Saṅgita Nikāya, it says clearly, if anyone asks forgiveness sincerely, you must always forgive them. Especially if that's your partner in life. Forgive them. Acknowledge that you're not perfect, they're not perfect. It reminds me of this lady in Singapore. True story. When she got married, her father took aside his new son-in-law to give him some advice. He told his new son-in-law, "You probably love my daughter very much." And the new son-in-law said, "She's absolutely perfect. She's so charming, beautiful. I'm so lucky to have married this incredible, wonderful woman." And the father-in-law said, "Yes, that's what it's like when you first fall in love. But after 2 years, maybe 3 years, you will start to see the faults and defects in my daughter. But when you start to see her defects, please keep this in mind. If she never had those faults and defects to begin with, she would have married someone much better than you." And it's true. Your partner will have faults and defects. Why? Because you have faults and defects as well. So in a marriage, you have to lower your expectations to what's really real and true. You will make mistakes and your partner will make mistakes. But if you do this little ceremony of forgiveness, I really mean it. Anything which I've done, said or thought, intentional or unintentional, by accident or things I didn't do, I sincerely am sorry. I care for you. I love you. Please forgive me. And then your partner reciprocates by also asking forgiveness. So once a year we can wipe the slate clean. So we don't keep these memories which are like cancers which eat away at our trust and respect for the person we live with. And that forgiveness ceremony is really, really effective. Because we do make mistakes. We are imperfect human beings, which is why we can irritate one another. But if we say sorry, even for things we don't know we've done. You know what it's like sometimes? Your wife is angry, "What did I do?" And she won't tell you. You know, you're supposed to find out. So sometimes when you do this wonderful, whatever I've done, body, speech, or mind, intentional or unintentional, the whole lot, okay, I'm sure I made mistakes. And she says, I've made mistakes as well. And that forgiveness ceremony is a wonderful cleansing and also re-establishing of your trust and respect and love for one another, which is a beautiful ceremony. It keeps you in harmony for a long time. And as a Buddhist monk, I really want you to live in peace and harmony together as married with married people. Because if you don't, you come and bother me. It's totally selfish. I want an easy, quiet life. So please, you get it together and stop bothering me. I became a monk to get rid of all these marriage problems, and now I get hundreds of them. And then you have your kids. Now, when you have kids, I will guarantee that 50% of your children will be below average intelligence. But you don't want, not my kids, other people's kids, okay, but not my kids. You always want your kids to be smart. And some of the kids haven't got the ability to be smart. And just because they don't do well, don't punish them and don't think they're bad children. If they don't finish high school, they don't finish university, don't think of that. We love your children for who they are. And in fact, I've gone around the world telling Buddhists, if your children come in the top 5% at school or university, or if they come in the bottom 5%, they are not good Buddhists. If your children are high achievers or low achievers, you're bad parents. You know why? Because in Buddhism, we believe in the middle way. If your children in the middle, good kids. You know, sometimes, imagine the pressure you put on your children to perform, to perform, to perform. And so all the children feel is pressure. They don't feel love. What is love to a child? You're in it together. You care for your kid. My father told me something once. It's a great story, but I can't resist telling this once again. My father took me aside when I was only 13, I think. And he said something to me which changed my life. And my respect for him went through the roof after I heard this. He said, son, you know, just with him, just my father and I. I still remember the place, Churchfield Road in Acton. I can recall it now. It's 50 years ago, at least. Yeah, 50 years ago. And he said, son, however you turn out in your life, wherever you go, whatever you become, I want you to always remember the door of my heart will always be open to you. I will never reject you. He's actually said the door of his house, but I always interpreted that as the door of his heart. You're my son, and that's enough. You don't have to live up to anything at all. I will always love you and care for you. You're my son. That's enough. It was unconditional love. And that was such a beautiful thing to receive. I didn't have to do well at school. I didn't have to become a good kid who never got into trouble. However I turned out, he would always love me and care for me and be my dad. To a young man, that was such a relief. I could just develop whichever way I wanted, whichever way I would become. And I never had to win my father's love. It was a given. Many of your children feel the only way they can be loved by their parents is to get straight A's at school. And that's why they pressure themselves so much. If you can tell your kids, if you fail at school, I'm still your mum, I'm still your dad, I will always love you, I will care for you. The door of my heart's always open to you, no matter what happens. If you can do that, then your kids will get straight A's. Like I did. Because I didn't have to, I wanted to. And that was totally different. I was motivated to live up to my Father's love. That was a very beautiful psychology. So please, if you haven't done that yet to your children, please do it soon. And please mean it. Son, daughter, you know, you're my family, you're my children. Wherever you go, however you turn out in life, the door of my heart will always, forever be open to you. And number two, in a family, I've told this again to people having children, please tell your kids, as long as you tell us the truth, I will never punish you. Because it happened to me, because I've been in Australia 30 years now, I've known kids, I've seen them grow up. They've known me, you know, since they were born. So I'm like their godfather, you know, like a second parent to them. And so once this girl came to me, she was about 16, said, Ajahn Brahm, can I talk to you? I said, what's the matter? She said, I'm pregnant. Have you told your parents yet? No, they'll kill me if they find out. That's why I've come to talk to you. Can you tell my parents for me? And, you know, I was honored, first of all, for that, you know, they trusted me enough and I could help them in a difficult situation. But I was also very concerned. Why is it that a girl in trouble, when she really needs the parents' help, is afraid to tell the parents the truth? Why is it that some boys, they may get into trouble with drugs or with the police, and they'll never tell their father? Because they're afraid of what you will do. The time a son needs a father most of all, they won't go to you. Why? Because they're afraid. So it's wonderful if you can tell your children, and this is serious business, this is not a joke, if you can tell your children, son, daughter, whatever happens to you in life, as long as you tell us the truth, you won't be punished. You won't be scolded, because you will make mistakes and I want to be there to help you in the most difficult times of your life. It is the fear of punishment which drives the truth underground. And as Buddhists, honesty is so important that we say, as long as you're honest and truthful, you can tell mum and dad anything. Even embarrassing stuff, shameful stuff, you won't be punished, because we're here to help you. And that will help your children enormously. If a husband and wife can say that to each other, that's even better. Darling, you know, you may be having an affair, but please be honest and tell me. And then we can fix it up. Because you tell me because you want help. A lot of times you won't tell them because you're just terrified of what your wife will say if she finds out. And it gets worse and worse. It's a problem. It's your wife, it's your husband. For goodness sake, share. And don't be so afraid. And that fear comes, you said a little thing before and you get scolded, shouted at. Fear of punishment drives the truth deeper and deeper underground. It hides it. So in a family, see if you can raise honesty, truth, to such a high level that it's the most important thing. And if you're any of your family members, whatever they say, as long as they're being honest, never punish them, never scold them. That's how my monastery works. Any monk, they can tell me anything. The most shameful, embarrassing things, as long as they're telling me the truth, never ever be punished. And I always praise them. Thank you, you told a difficult thing. Well done. Now I've heard that. Now we can try and fix it together. Because a family is about us. And lastly, about money. I know all about money because I've got none. But what is money for? Remember that money is for a purpose. When you get the list of priorities, money is not the top priority. It's for a purpose, for your happiness and well-being. To be able to enjoy life. And what's the purpose of making so much money? And so much money, you become so stressed out, you have a heart attack and become the richest person in the cemetery. And what a waste of time that is. There's many rich people in the cemetery, and they can't enjoy their wealth. So if you have wealth, use it. In other words, you know, use it for your own happiness, for your family's happiness, for society, for, you know, Buddhist monasteries. Whatever it is, because you do get much more happiness when you've used it for a good cause. Everybody knows, every psychologist knows, you have $20, you spend it on yourself or you spend it on somebody else, which makes you happier? It's always spending on somebody else. You get so much more happiness with generosity and sharing. So money is this great resource which should be exploited. And don't worry about, oh, I've got to save it for my future, for security. Look at me, what security do I have? I have no savings, no pension funds, nothing in the bank for my old age. But what do I have? I have my friends. I've cared for many of you. And I know if I get sick, if I have a heart attack on this stage, I'll be well taken care of. Many of you will be fighting to pay my hospital bills. Me. No. I'm going to pay for it. No. I want to pay for it. I have to be very careful when I'm giving a talk. If I have got a cough, I try to suppress it. I never try and cough in public. The reason, if I cough once, even before the talk is finished, I've got all this medicine in front of me. And they say, this is Chinese medicine, it's really good, you must take this. And this is Western medicine, I'm a doctor, this really worked for me. This is Ayurvedic medicine, you must take this, it's really good, it's natural. This is homeopathic medicine, you must take this, it really, really works. This is, and I get so many medicines, and you make me promise that I will take it. And I do take it because I keep my promises, and then I really get sick. But so that's my insurance policy. For my old age, for my sickness, the kindness which I've shown other people, my good karma is my insurance policy. The same for you, your family and friends, the loved ones, the people you've cared about. And you'll find when you're in trouble, if it's another GFC and you lose all your money, it's your friends and family, the ones who love you, the ones who you have loved. They will be your pension fund in the future. And it really, really works. It's the kindness you've given to others comes back to help you. One last story before we do the Q&A. This is one of my favorite stories. There was a doctor in the US. He was a specialist, a cancer specialist, I forget what area. But he was given a case by some of his friends, this poor old lady who had such a severe, advanced, aggressive cancer that no other doctor was interested in trying to help her. They'd all given up on her as incurable. But when he saw the case files, he decided that he would give this woman a try. He went to extraordinary lengths for this woman, calling in favors from other doctors throughout the US and giving every possible opportunity to care for her. And because, you know, he went the extra mile for this woman, she got into remission. It worked. And when she got the bill, you know, she was almost going to die from opening the envelope because the hospital bills in the US, you know, are extreme. They're not thousands of dollars, they're hundreds of thousands of dollars, especially for all the treatment she had received. Now, before I'm going to tell you what the bill said, you've got to go back 30 or 40 years. When this doctor was a medical student I think in Colombia. And he came from a poor home. So during the vacation period, he'd take any jobs he could find to try and pay his way through med school. And one of the jobs was as a door-to-door salesman. And one day he'd been trying to sell I don't know what door-to-door through New York. He'd knocked on one person's house, and this young woman answered. And she said, "No, I don't want anything, thank you." But then she paused and said, "Young man, have you had anything to eat today yet?" It was mid-afternoon. And honestly, he said, "No, I haven't. Wait for a few moments." And she got a glass of milk and two cookies and gave it to this young medical student, you know, selling door-to-door to pay his way through med school. When this old lady opened the envelope, she saw on the medical bill the words scrawled by the doctor, "Paid 35 years ago with one glass of milk and two cookies." This doctor had seen the name of this incurable cancer case, and it rang a bell. The lady hadn't moved from the address. It was the young lady who had offered him a glass of milk and two cookies. That's all. He remembered her kindness. And now, seeing it was the same woman, he decided to go the extra mile for her. He cured her, and he paid the bill himself. Paid 35 years ago with a glass of milk and two cookies. What a wonderful story. Now that is how we use our money. Insurance for the future is acts of kindness and goodness. A glass of milk and two cookies is your investment for your medical insurance in the future. Thank you all for listening. Okay, here we go. The questions, comments, and complaints.
Okay, thank you, Ajahn. Thank you very much. And your talk does provoke a lot of questions. Okay, perhaps I can read some of the questions already been written down, and then I will open the floor for someone who wants to directly ask questions to Ajahn. Okay, Ajahn, my parents. My parents are very traditional Chinese parents, and they're convinced that they have not fully fulfilled their duty, nor can be happy, unless their children, okay, married and have children, okay? Because some parents don't feel completed if their children not getting married, okay? So that's why I got a bad relationship with them currently. What does one do for this kind of situation? The parents want me to get married, but I might not want to. Something like that.
Okay, now one thing to do is, I'm not going to say he's a Chinese person, see if you can find some person they really dislike. I know sometimes the Cantonese don't like the Hokkien. Is that correct?
No. Yes, they don't understand your chatter sometimes.
So. Okay, well, no, find a Hokkien person, get engaged to them, you know, even pay them a bit of money, make it a forced one, and then tell your parents, "Look, you know, I'm going to marry a Hokkien girl or Hokkien boy," and then they might say, "No, no, 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 no." You say, "Okay," and then you get out of a problem. No, seriously. Traditions can be very useful, but remember, traditions have traditionally changed. There wasn't always a tradition in Chinese culture. It's grown, it gets less, it gets more, it changes, it mutates. And there are some traditions which have to change. And sometimes, if you get a senior Buddhist monk or a senior person in the community who can tell them that is not necessary. For example, in funeral ceremonies, You know, we have all this burning of paper houses, burning of hell money and heaven money, and all this other stupid stuff which goes on. Costs a fortune for the family. Totally unnecessary. In Malaysia, there was a great group, the Malaysian Buddhist Cooperative, who wrote these books to say it is not necessary. And I did a foreword for that. Dr. Kesri Dhammananda did a foreword to that. I forget who was a Mahayana senior monk, did a foreword for it. We all got together, influential, well-respected senior monks said, you don't need to do this. We are changing that old tradition because that's hurting and harming people. And it's important that when there are traditions which are causing suffering, you know, to the children and to the parents, please, for goodness sake, senior members of the community need to stand up and say, that is wrong. So the ordinary mothers and fathers in Hong Kong, they can get support that they do not need to cause suffering like that. You don't need to feel fulfilled if your children don't get married. You are fulfilled if your children are happy. Now that's the Buddhist way. And that should be every culture's way. If your children are happy and successful, you've done a great job as parents. Not just because they're married. So traditions are there to be, to grow, to mutate, to change. And please keep the good traditions, but just because it's English tradition, just because it's English tradition, you always have to have a cup of tea at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That's a stupid tradition. That's the reason why the British lost their empire. They were too busy drinking tea and not working.
Thank you, Ajahn. Since my parents are not here, I want my parents to hear about this. But I once discussed the same issue with my parents, and I said, Mom, during my temporary ordination, okay, this is what we discussed. And I said, Dad, Mom, as long as your kid, like me, is happy, and it's okay, right? And my father, you know what my father said to me? He said, okay, aren't you a Buddhist? You only concern your own happiness, okay? I'm not happy. So what should I reply then?
Well, you should ask your father, are you a Buddhist? Are you only concerned about your happiness, Dad? No, it is the job of parents. The parents are the ones who should give. You give life to your child. You know, you give an education to your child. And if what you've given is rewarded with happiness, then that should be sufficient for you. As a parent, it's always about what you can give, not what you get. And so that's in life. For me, it's not what I get. I don't get anything out of teaching you guys, except getting tired. I've got enough work to do. But that's not the point. I enjoy giving. I get so much fun out of giving to others. And as I mentioned, if you give to others and all the people who've given to make this event possible, you get so much joy out of this. So as parents, please, as a Buddhist parents, as a Chinese parents, as a human being, it's your delight to give. So it's not what I want for my children, it's what I can give to them.
Okay, second question. Forgiveness is surely important to keep and develop a relationship. But is it also possible that one will be given a bad incentive to keep doing bad if she or he knows the partner will always forgive her or him?
You may think that is giving a blank check to your partner, because that's like what my father said to me. He's given me a blank check. I can do anything, whatever I liked in life. I'd always have a home to go to, a place to sleep, food. I'd always have my father's house to go to. But psychologically, it doesn't work like that. If somebody trusts you that much to always forgive you, you know, 99% of human beings would value you have an amazing partner. You are so lucky to get someone who trusts you, who really loves you enough to forgive you. That's just a fantastic partner to get. And if you get something so valuable like a precious diamond, you will never lose it. Now, if you had a diamond in your bag this evening, you'll be checking your bag every 5 minutes to make sure it's still there. If you have a partner like that, you'll be checking every 5 minutes that you've still got them. They're so valuable, so precious, that you will never abuse them. So have that inspiration, that trust. If you do give such forgiveness to another person, they will love you so much for it. They will live up to your trust. They will never live down to it. They live up to it. Try it out and see. This is what works.
Okay, after this question, I'm going to open the floor for your direct question to Ajahn. Ajahn, hi. Some people say, I spoil my kid for not beating him when he's naughty, okay? What do you say? Will my son be spoiled if I do not beat him?
Remember, your son will remember all those beatings. And when you get old and he's much stronger than you, you better be careful.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That's a very important advice to all parents, okay? I'm going to open the floor. If you have any question, please raise up your hand. A show of hands, please. Oh, over there, that lady. Yes, yes.
Oh. I have three questions.
Wow. Oh, okay. I'm not a monk, sorry, I'm not that compassionate, so I have to say, can you just pick the most important question so we can give other people some chances? Okay, thank you.
Okay, like, I just want to know about the duck and chicken questions. I just have that, like, if the duck is really a duck, like, but the man said it's a chicken in order to comfort her, could it be considered as lying? And if it is so, then is it okay to lie to have a happy life? I don't know, it's just a small thing like duck and chicken. But how do you decide small and big?
Yeah, the main thing is, just because it goes quack, quack, you don't know that it's a duck. You know, just if you see it, you know, with a beak and duck features, you still don't know it's a duck. It could be a duck in disguise working for the CIA, an undercover chicken. Now, I don't mean to be sort of debase your question, but this is it, that sometimes that whenever we make a conclusion, it's always on incomplete evidence. And we jump to conclusions so often. But it's not lying, it's giving your partner the benefit of the doubt. So I'm not really sure. I can't be sure. So give them the benefit of the doubt. And it's not lying, it's acknowledging that sometimes we get all the information, we add it all up and we get the wrong answer. The trouble is, we're always so damn sure we're right. You know, and I told this story years ago, and have we got time to tell another story here?
We got a lot of time.
Yeah. Okay, great. I was talking about sex, and I talked about I'm a good monk. But you know, there are some monks who misbehave. And it was many years ago, it seemed to be there was one monk after another misbehaving in Thailand. You know, having mistresses, caught in bed with women. And, you know, that's against our rules. We're not supposed to do that. But one evening, in front of about 300 people in my temple in Perth, I decided to actually to teach them something. I decided to make a confession. And I was very serious. And I said to everybody, I said, I need to get this off my chest. I said, some years previously, I had spent some of the happiest moments of my life in the loving arms of another man's wife. I did it. We kissed, we hugged. She loved me, I loved her, and she was married to somebody else. I did that. Was that bad? Was that adultery? That woman was my mother. She was another man's wife. We hugged, we kissed, had some of the most wonderful... I loved her, she loved me. Now, the reason I tell that story, how many of you thought that was adultery? That was, you know, with some floozy who was married to somebody else. You can see how easy it is. Because it goes quack, quack, you think it must be a duck. Now, that is very good little... I'm glad you didn't remember that. That story was in my first book, Open the Door of Your Heart. I'm glad you didn't remember that, because how many of you thought that Ajahn Brahm was a bad monk? You did, didn't you? So I could see by your face, you think, oh my God, what's he done? But when you give the full picture, this is totally innocent. There's nothing wrong there at all. It's your mother, another man's wife. So that is why be very careful to judge. Because we always judge on just insufficient evidence. We never know the full story. Which is why it's not lying to say it might be a chicken. It's just acknowledging that sometimes we jump to conclusions in life and we cause a lot of harm thereby. Do you understand?
Good. Thank you. We might come back to you if we still got time, okay, for your other questions. Anyone? Oh, sir, can we give a microphone to the gentleman over there?
Yeah, my question is that in my very small experience of going to a lot of lectures and different spiritual things in my search, I found, why is it so rare for people in the spiritual world, or at least traditional like Buddhism or other things, to ever talk about the area of sex? Is it, I was just curious, because it seems such an important topic that if we don't get guidance from those that we respect and those that have wisdom, then many people, young and even old, will be distracted by whatever they can find.
Exactly. That's why I'm very happy to give this talk tonight. But you know, it's not traditional for monks who are celibate to talk about sex. You know, we marry people, even though we're celibate. Roman Catholic priests marry, but they're celibate. The Pope tells you what to do with abortion, but the Pope's never been pregnant. But you know, this is the problem. Sometimes you've got to be careful. You're not being a hypocrite, that you can actually speak with authority. And of course, you know, I had sex before I became a monk. I was sexually active as a young man in the 60s and 70s. So you have some experience. And also, that because you understand the human mind and emotions, you know, I can hopefully say a few things which is helpful, which makes sense, which can enhance that experience, but also to make it more spiritual, more deep, more safe, less problems. And hopefully some of the things I've said can be helpful. They're practical. I never actually got into homosexual sexual relationships. But there is totally, in Buddhism, I can quote sutras and stuff, there is nothing wrong with that. It's not sin, it's not evil at all. So any gay people or lesbians here, I respect you, you're welcome as a Buddhist, thank you for being who you are, and I apologize for all the hurt and harm which religion has given you. Please, you are welcome. The door of my heart and all Buddhist hearts should be open to people of all sexual orientations. At that gay and lesbian Mardi Gras, there's a wonderful story. There was a gay activist in the Australian state of Tasmania. And at that time, homosexual sex was illegal. You know, it was in the statute books, if two men had sex, consensual, in private, it was against the law. So the homosexual people in Tasmania, they talked to the government, no, please, this is offensive to us. This is Australia. This is, I think, 2000 and something, and 6 or 7. Please repeal it. And the point, don't worry about it. We will never prosecute you. And this is not realizing just how that affects other people. You know, thinking that you know better. You know how they got that law overturned? This was brilliant action. A whole group of homosexual couples, about 50 of them, they agreed that one night they would all have as much sex as they possibly could together, and they recorded it all, wrote it all down, exactly what they did, how they did it, and these 50 couples went to the police station to hand themselves in. They said, look, we've done a crime, we've had homosexual sex tonight. We admit it, we confess, arrest us. And they had all the media, the TV cameras and the press in tow. And said, arrest us. And these were really good people, prominent citizens in the community, contributing much to the cultural and economic life of that state. And the government was so embarrassed that within a week they changed the law. They said, look, it's against the law, arrest us. And they just could not do that because it was a bad law. So sometimes that affirmative action was just absolutely brilliant. It embarrassed the politicians so much that they had to change the law. And it was brilliant what they did. Great action. So anyway, that's just a nice little story of how to make, especially our governments who make these laws, to realize that they're embarrassed by what they're doing. Anyway, any other questions? Couple questions? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We will, because of the time, this will be our second last question, and we'll take one more question after this.
Okay. Firstly, a little follow-up. I'm wondering if Ajahn has anything further to say about the beating of children.
Yeah.
Secondly, this is my question. It's about how to set limits to on a child's behavior when you're trying to teach a child something. You want to give them freedom, but then you also need to set some limits.
Exactly.
So, what is the middle way?
Exactly. You do set limits on kids, and you have to be consistent, which is one of the first things I learned as a teacher. So the child knows exactly what the boundaries are. And you can't change the boundaries. And if you say this is against the rules of the house, if you say that, you have to make that rule enforceable. Because if they break one rule and they don't get any sort of feedback, then they'll break other rules. They don't know what they can do, what they can't do. So you have to be consistent. Number two, if you set a boundary, it has to be something you're willing to enforce. So if you say they're going to go into detention if they don't get their homework in on time, you have to enforce that. So, you know, it has to be fair. And so many children realize as long as they know what the rules are and it's fair, they will usually abide by those rules. But of course, they will always be testing boundaries, which is what kids do. But beating them is just telling them that violence works. And you're bigger than they are, so you can use violence on them. When they get bigger in school, they will bully and use violence over smaller children. Because you're teaching them that violence is a good way of controlling other people. And you all know where that leads, in the violence in our world. Riot police beating protesters, people being beaten by police in jails, armies bombing other people. The violence leads to more violence. So we are trying to teach our children, you know, the future of our planet Earth. There's other ways, instead of beating, to make a person realize they have crossed a boundary and they need to be restrained. There's so many other ways that you can discipline a child. Now, one of them is grounding them, taking away privileges. But the best way of disciplining a child is not through punishment, but through rewards. Rewarding good behavior. So this is a classic psychology. If you punish bad behavior, a lot of times what the kid learns is how to not get caught next time. To do it when father can't see it. Now that's what we learn. If we have speed cameras in Hong Kong, do you have these little devices which warn you where the speed cameras are? That's all the speed cameras teach you, is how to know where the speed cameras are and slow down before you get caught. And this is trouble with punishment. We always learn how to avoid the punishment. That's what I learned at school, how not to get caught by the teacher. Not why I should be good. But if you reward good behavior, then you find the good behavior grows. And it's that teaching law of karma. It's not just you do bad, you get punished. You do good, you get rewards. So discipline your child with rewards. If they clean up their room, they get a reward. If they do their homework, they get a reward. And you find that's a far more effective incentive than if you don't do your homework, you get beaten. That's a far more effective way of disciplining children. And also discipline throughout our whole world. Reward is more effective. It's called positive reinforcement. A good example of that, another little story, when I was in the US a few years ago, there was a fellow who's making a fortune in teaching dogs how to urinate and poo, you know, outside the house rather than inside the house, you know, in the apartments. Because people had little pets, and the pets were always putting their leg up against the sofa and peeing on the furniture. You know, they're puppies, they're young dogs. So this person, he would, himself and his workers, they would train the puppy and they had 100% success. What they did was take the puppy or the little dog outside into the park or next to a tree somewhere outside. And wait, and wait, and wait. And when the dog weed on the tree, they would just almost like throw a party, do cartwheels, punch the air, yes! No, sing a happy song. They would just go over the top in ecstasy. And the dog would see that and feel that. And even the dog realized they'd made a human being ecstatic. And that, because they were over the top in the praise and the joy, soon the dogs always learned to pee outside instead of in the room. And that he was making a small fortune for himself until the problem arose. Because this dog, trained like that, would be in the apartment when the owner was watching the football. And then someone would score a goal. Yes! Yes! And the dog would be on the sofa. And that actually was a true story.
Thank you, Ajahn. Okay, our last questions from the audience. Okay, we'll give the chance to the lady sitting over there.
Okay.
Okay? Second. You approve, Ajahn?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Where's there you go.
Good evening, Ajahn. My mom's got a friend who was sexually abused by her husband. And the family was undergoing a financial crisis because her husband gambles. So how do we deal with it from the Buddhist perspective? Thank you.
Okay, so I didn't quite understand the family dynamics. Who was sexually abused?
The wife.
The wife by her husband?
Yep.
Okay, so raped or something against her will?
Yeah, sexually abused by her husband.
Yes. What do you think about sexual abuse and physically abused between husband and wife?
Between husband and wife. Okay. Again, there's obviously a problem there that the husband feels that they have the rights to have sex with their wife against their will. It's a selfish thing. It's all about me, what I need. And what I was saying, you know, in the sexual relationships between husbands and wives, between partners, you know, it always should be not about what I want or what he wants or she wants, but what we want. The whole relationship is off to a bad start there. So if, you know, she has been sexually abused, raped, beaten, whatever it is, that there comes a time that she has to report that to the police to protect herself, because sexual abuse like that, it doesn't stop. She gets very physically damaged. Usually in a country like Australia, that guy has to go to very severe counseling. He probably will go to jail for that, for a crime against a woman. Because, you know, that is totally unacceptable. That is torture. That is abuse. And so, first of all, the whole family, if you don't want him to go to jail, you know, that they have to say, you need some very heavy counseling, and do it right now, quick, otherwise it's a jail term for you. Now, I think is that the law in Hong Kong? Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, so, you know, he's in big trouble there. You may give him a chance and say, look, you can't do that again, totally, you will go to jail. Let him know that. Need an incentive. And the other thing with abuse or even gambling, that sometimes in any addiction or bad behavior like that, you will find the person doesn't realize they're doing bad behavior. They think it's okay. They're doing nothing wrong. That when they take alcohol, they're not drunk, even though they're really falling over themselves. That they're not got a problem with gambling, even though they're losing all the money of the family. This is not sexual abuse, this is my wife. So one way of dealing with that, the person has to realize they're doing something really bad and wrong. You know, a really great way of doing that these days is getting out your mobile phone and actually videoing them when they're drunk. Videoing them when they're gambling. Letting them see themselves later on. Because a lot of times we don't realize what we're doing. When I was a school teacher, training to be a school teacher, they videoed each student giving a 5-minute lesson to other students. And they played it back to us. It was the first time in my life I saw what I looked like when I was speaking. And they did that for teachers because if you are teaching a class of school children and you've got some idiosyncrasy like always scratching your cheek, always scratching your cheek, the children after 5 minutes in front of you will all be sitting there. That's what children are like in school. So it's great for a teacher to know what they look like to the students. Anyone with an addiction like that, they need to see what they look like. Especially if you've got a father or mother who gets drunk. Video them, for goodness sake. And when they're sober, show it to themselves. Dad, this is what you look like, how you behave when you're drunk. It's a wake-up call. And once you realize it's a problem, there's hundreds of solutions. But the first step, you know, that you know you're abusing someone, is to realize what you're doing. That person doesn't realize what they're doing. They think it's okay. Somehow you've got to video them if at all possible or something so they realize what's going on. And then the solutions are many.
Okay. Just because I like this question very much, so I have to ask it. Ajahn, how to resist temptation to have affairs outside marriage? Okay. Oh my goodness. In particular, for Hong Kong men traveling in a country with a lot of beautiful women like China.
Number one, all men think they won't be caught. They think they'll get away with it. 2 years ago, the head of the CIA got caught having an affair, if the head of the most powerful espionage agency in the world gets caught out, you have got no chance. They know about covert operations. They know how to keep things secret. But still, his wife found out. So number one, you will be found out. Take that as granted. Now that will stop a lot of affairs if you knew you're going to be found out. Because then you think, what are my kids going to think of me? It's such a shameful thing to be found out. Your kids get really upset at you. They lose all their faith in you. What type of lesson are you giving your kids? It's okay to lie and cheat on their mother. You will lose the respect of your children. And you'll probably lose their love. And they won't want anything to do with you again. Is that worth it? Losing your children over a little bit of sex? If you want an affair, have an affair with your wife. Play fantasy games. Dress her up as a beautiful Chinese person. And play fantasy. Oh, darling, we can have an affair. But it's really your wife dressed up, okay? So, but you do get attracted. Now, first of all, to you women, why does your husband have an affair with the young Chinese girl? Are you really performing your part in the marriage? Are you saying, I don't feel like sex tonight, darling, I'm tired. Not tonight, I'm busy. No, you know, please, if you don't give sexual satisfaction to your husband, of course he's going to go somewhere else. So, you know, to be fair, that some affairs are actually just, it's not just the husband's fault. It's always our fault, remember? You know, your relationship, you know, is not active enough. So, you know, just make yourself attractive to your husband. You know, and just realize, you know, that this is a marriage. You're not a celibate monk and a celibate nun living together, for goodness sake. So, you know, you do make sex part of your relationship. Because, you know, if you don't have sex, you know, with your wife's going to go and find sex somewhere else. Remember that. So that's one of the reasons why men have affairs. Because the wife won't have sex with them. It's true. Because I know a case of that recently. So, and you husbands, you know, if you do get attracted, you're having good sex with your wife, it's not so important having sex with someone else. So just make it fun. Make it sensual. Now, one of the monks in my monastery gave this advice. He's an old monk, so he doesn't mind giving this advice. You know, turn each other on. One of the advice he said, have a bath together. Or go in the shower together. Do sexy stuff together. You know, go to Victoria's Secret and get some sexy lingerie. I don't know. There's so many ways you can excite each other. Do it. You know, play games. Play fantasies. Have a rich sexual life together. And if you have such a rich sexual life together as a couple, you know, you are lessening the odds that your partner will go somewhere else. Why do I need to go somewhere else? I have a great time with my wife, with my husband. Why do I need to go somewhere else? So please remember that too. And if you do go overseas, remember you will get caught. It's just basically not worth it. The dangers exceed the pleasures. And also remember that a lot of times that the Chinese woman, they don't love you, they love your wallet. They wouldn't have anything to do with you if you were poor. Now be honest, because this is men's conceit. Now they're 40 or 50, they're old, and they always want to still feel attractive. They can still pull a nice young girl. You're not pulling the girl, your wallet is, your credit card. That's what she loves, not you. Be honest about it. Because that's the conceit is otherwise. Ah, you know, I must be still young and attractive. I'm only, well, you know, 65 and a bit. And a bit is usually 10 years.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, Ajahn, first of all, I really, really want to, I think I have this honor to represent every one of you to thank you very much for coming to Hong Kong. And sometime Hong Kong is very proud of its position to being the world's financial center. So I think the biggest religion in Hong Kong, certainly not Buddhism, but money religion, okay? And I hope you will give your final advice to the people of Hong Kong, how we can keep up our spiritual practice to cope with this very busy, crowded, and money-related place.
Okay, just the last piece of advice. It was a story I remember from my master, Ajahn Chah, who actually did make a prediction. In the future, there will not be enough metal left in the world for coins, nor will there be enough paper left or plastic left for banknotes. So the world will have to find something else to use as currency. And he suggested that in the future the currency would be little pellets of chicken shit. And you would put all the chicken shit in your pocket when you go out to buy something. And you'd be so concerned at who's got the most chicken shit in Hong Kong. And the IMF will become the International Manure Fund with big reserves of chicken shit. And people will fight wars over chicken shit. And they would wonder, who is making the most chicken shit in the world? Because what is the difference between money and chicken shit? It's only the value you give on it. It's just stone, it's metal from the ground. It's just paper or plastic. It's the value we give on these things makes it money. So it's a value which we put on something. It's not intrinsic. No more than you can put value on chicken shit unless we all decide that chicken shit is valuable. And you can imagine people doing that. So that's Ajahn Chah's. So what is money? It's only the value you put on that piece of paper, on that credit card, on those bank statements. So because you put value on it, you can put different values on things. And the value should not be on the money. It should be on what the money is there for your happiness, for your family. There's so many things you say that money can't buy. Why? Because they are priceless. What value is it on a human life? How much are you worth? How much would you pay when you're sick to keep yourself alive? How much would you pay for your child who's got leukemia so that they can live and grow? How much is a human life worth? These are important things. And so when we remember what's really valuable in life, we change our priorities. Money is valuable. But our family, our love, our children, our happiness, that is more valuable. When you change the value system and put money in its proper place, then maybe Hong Kong won't be the financial capital of the world. It will be the family capital, the happiness capital. Bhutan, gross national happiness, not gross national product, becomes the driving force of our world. You all know that we're going in the wrong direction. There are things which are much more important. Remember those things. So don't go working extra hours to get more money, and you're neglecting your family and your health. You've got your priorities all the upside down. So, last little story, I told this earlier. Boy was waiting for his father to come home, 6-year-old. When his father returned home from work late, the son asked, "Daddy, How much do you earn at work? None of your business. I'm tired. But Daddy, how many dollars do you earn at work? I told you, 6-year-old has no business knowing that. But Daddy, how much do you earn? Right, 3 times I've said no. Grounded, up to your room. So the poor son went up to his room and closed his bedroom door. And the father, after having a cup of tea and relaxing, he realized he was angry at his kid because he came home stressed out from work. He made a mistake, so he went up to his son's room to apologize. I'm sorry I shouted at you. I was just tired. I don't know why a 6-year-old wants to know how much I earn at work, but it's $20 an hour, okay? Thank you, Daddy, said the son. Now can I please borrow $10? And the father had argued with his son once and didn't want to do it again. So he gritted his teeth, took out his wallet, and gave his son a $10 bill. Thank you, Daddy, said the son. And the son reached into a drawer and took out another $10 in coins, counted out $20, gave it to his daddy, and said, Now, Daddy, can I please have 1 hour of your time? Do you understand? So what's more important, being with your children or making more money? Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Ajahn, when we come to listen your lecture, every time with you, we're not just come to receiving a teaching from a great Buddhist master, but rather like we are come to have a very casual sharing with a friend. That's why we feel relaxed and without fear. And then we can connect with you. Ladies and gentlemen, a master and a great friend, Ajahn Brahm. And I do hope, you will think the same. I do hope Ajahn will come to Hong Kong more often, right? Okay. Thank you very much for coming today. And we will love to see you more and more for this Buddhist teachings sessions. And ladies and gentlemen, have a good night and bye-bye.